This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, if you hadn't learned about bats from childhood, you'd swear they were a prank. These odd-looking animals occupy a unique space in the animal kingdom. Among other rare traits, they are the only mammals with powered flight. Scientists have found bat fossils dating back 55 million years, but they still don't know how they evolved. Joining me today to talk about bats is Greg Gunnell. He's director of the Division of Fossil Primates at the Duke Lemur Center and a bat researcher. He's going to give a talk on Saturday at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences Paleopalooza in Raleigh at 12:30, but first joins me in the studio. Greg Gunnell, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Pleasure to be here.
I suppose as a segue out of the Comic-Con, we should talk about Batman right away, but I guess the evolution of that is not your specialty. Tell us about these fossils now and what we know about them.
Well, interestingly, the things that we know are bats are obviously bats, and they go back about 52 million years, 53 million years, and we have skeletons, so we can really identify the features that are obviously related to flight and echolocation sounds that are produced by bats to fly at night. Before that, we have a lot of scrappy fossils that might be bats, but we don't really have enough to be absolutely certain. Mostly we have teeth and jaws. And while we think they probably are bats, it's not a slam dunk for sure.
Right. And they are mammals.
Yes, they certainly are
mammals. So how far back do mammals go, and where do we think the bat sort of showed up on that?
Well, bats are kind of latecomers in the story of mammal evolution. Mammals themselves go back over 200 million years and lived a very long time with dinosaurs. A lot of people don't realize that, but they were a large diversity of mammals living from about 200 million years ago on up. And bats show up, like I said, about 52, 53 million. So a little late in that story, really.
And what do we know about their evolution? Where did they come from?
Well, there's a lot of different ideas, but we're pretty sure now, based on genetic information of living bats, that they're most closely related to things like carnivores, dogs and cats, and things we call insectivores like shrews and hedgehogs, things like that. It's not entirely sure which of those groups is most closely related, but they're in that group originally, certainly.
So. But what's fascinating to me now is today they are not in any group. They are their own group.
They
right?
are their own order, separated out by the features that everybody knows about bats, particularly the wings, that are very, very unique. They're not like bird wings, for example. They're derived in a completely different way. Other people are aware of that most of them, many of them at least, hunt by using this sort of sonar radar detection system. And so those are features that make them completely unique amongst all mammals for sure.
Well, let's talk about this echolocation and, first of all, the sheer number of species. There are lots of varieties.
Yes, bats are second only to rodents in terms of the diversity around the world. Probably 1,300 to 1,400 species living today. There's probably about 400, 300 or 400 identified fossil species. So clearly, we're a diverse and very successful radiation for a long time. And of those, almost all except for one group are echolocating forms.
And what about their eyesight? Did they sort of sacrifice eyesight for echolocation?
That's kind of an old wives' tale. Yeah. I think that bats are blind as a bat or whatever. Yeah. But bats actually see quite well and don't really don't rely on that as much at night, obviously. But during evening when they first start flying, they oftentimes will fly without producing echolocation sounds because they can see well enough to do that.
So is part of their success the fact that they are indeed mammals? They're not birds, but they're nocturnal mostly? Are they mostly nocturnal?
Yeah, they are mostly active at night.
Yeah. Does this give them an advantage over birds, other flying animals?
Sure. I mean, birds kind of stop being active at night except for owls and, a couple of other groups of birds that are active at night. So bats took advantage of this wide open niche, really, of night insect hunting, and I'm sure that's why that most of them are as successful as they are, because insects are plentiful at night, and bats are very adept at hunting them. So,
and as you say, most of these animals tend to be tiny; they tend to be small. Right?
Yeah, but most bats weigh on the order of 10 grams or less, which is what a quarter or something. I mean, if you looked at your own hand and held up your thumb, that's about the size of the body of a typical bat. I mean, you see images of large fruit bats, and some do get to be 5 pounds or more, but that's really the maximum extent of bats. And outside of that one group, most are quite small.
And it's fascinating when you see them and start thinking about the fact that they are just so unlike birds. I mean, those leathery wings, flaps on the wing,
exactly,
is nothing like a feathered wing.
Yeah.
And they obviously started flying at a very different starting point for them. They'd already evolved a lot of other stuff, so feathers wasn't ever going to be part of their story.
No, exactly.
Right?
And, you know, we have a pretty good idea about when bats started to take wing, because the earliest bats that we're sure are bats are primitive in many ways. They have shorter wings, they have longer legs, you know, so they do differ from living bats in ways that you might predict of an animal that maybe it was just transitioning into sort of fluttering flight or something like that, or from a gliding form maybe or something like that. And these earliest bats, we have pretty good evidence that they weren't echolocating. So flight probably started first, and echolocation came along shortly thereafter, and in probably a rudimentary way at first, maybe just as a sort of a navigational tool in the evening and when it started to get dark, and then later co-opted to be more of a hunting skill as well, or developed further and was refined to today, when some bats are remarkably skilled at hunting at night and you know, can fly through a cluttered room, pitch black room, and run into absolutely nothing. So it's really quite amazing.
So how many differences? I mean, I think you've just described a few. When you've got these fossils dating back 55 million years, how much change has there been, and what other changes have you seen?
Most of them are fairly subtle. One of the things is that the earliest bats still have claws on all of their hand digits, and all modern bats have lost their claws except for on the thumb. So that's kind of an obvious thing that you can see. And then the proportions of the wings are much different. In the very earliest bats, they're kind of proportioned like a sloth or something more than a bat, because in modern bats, the forelimbs, the arms and hands, become very elongate. And in fact, it's the fingers that get very elongate and hold the flight patagium or the flight membrane. It's not the arm so much, although the arm does get longer. And then the feet get quite short relative to the forelimbs, and then they develop this sort of upside down hanging posture, which is very unique as well.
And that leads to the difference in principles in bird flight and bat flight.
Right.
They operate, and describe that for us.
Yeah, I mean, bats tend to, I mean, almost all of them rest upside down, and so it's very easy in terms of initiating flight to simply just let go with your feet and you're flying for the most part. And birds tend to take off from the ground or from trees and oftentimes use their legs to power upward first and then start flying, or to jump off in some way. You can even see that if you watch your birds at a bird feeder. You can see how they sort of hop as they take off. And typically, most bats don't do that, although they are capable of taking off on the ground. It's a little bit more cumbersome sometimes, but not impossible.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. I mean, I guess you could sort of imagine that if that's your takeoff pattern, then you need to keep flying until you get home.
Right.
But you're saying they can land and take off.
They do. I mean, a lot of bats don't. I mean, I was talking about bats that fly and you know, capture prey on the wing or whatever, but a lot of bats don't. I mean, they roost or they rest in trees, and they will listen for insects and attack them on the ground sometimes. So they hunt in a lot of different ways. It just depends on what's available to eat at a given time of year.
Any guesses about how they evolved flight?
My sense is that they were part of a group of animals that lived in the trees early on, maybe 60 million years or so ago. And once you're up in the trees, you kind of have options, you know, to either stay kind of like a squirrel, maybe, and just run along tops of branches. Maybe instead of that, taking advantage of being able to leap like primates do. Primates are jumpers for the most part, and they jump from tree to tree. Some animals developed a gliding kind of to go from one tree to the next, for example, in a fairly easy way. And this may have been the start to a sort of a powered flight. It's a little hard to know for sure, but it makes sense knowing what we know about the earliest bats that we have so far.
And it is interesting. There are other gliding mammals, flying squirrels,
Flying
squirrels and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But this is a sort of a categorical difference. Also interesting that maybe other mammals didn't kind of take that route and occupy a niche, but apparently these bats had pretty much taken it over once they found it.
Yeah, it is a little surprising, I suppose, that, I mean, for example, marsupials, another large group of mammals that are related to the placental mammals that we know around here today, developed many of the same kinds of adaptations that placental mammals did, but they never developed powered flight for some reason or other. And it was a very unique happening and apparently only happened once in mammals as far as we can tell.
And they may remain successful. What's the greatest threat to bats these days?
Pretty much like most animals, it's habitat destruction and just shrinking places for them to live. Because, they really do live virtually all over the globe from about the only areas the bats don't occupy are the polar areas. And so they really have a very broad distribution, but it's shrinking just like many animals are under duress.
We've heard about fungal infections in habitat as well.
Yeah, that's a common occurrence amongst some of the bats that live here in North Carolina. Yeah. Bats that hibernate especially are vulnerable to what's called white nose syndrome, which is a fungus that grows on their faces. And during the times that they're in torpor or when they're hibernating, and oftentimes it forces them or it causes them to wake up at times that they wouldn't typically wake up, like in the middle of the winter. And they wake up and they try to go out to hunt because they're hungry or whatever. Right. And, there's nothing to eat. And
obviously.
It's cold, and that's their demise, obviously.
Yeah, so. You really don't want your metabolism revving up when there's no energy to
replace
it with.
Exactly.
Right? So that's you mentioned one of the important myths. Bats have very good eyesight.
Right.
How many of them are interested in my jugular vein?
Virtually none. There is a vampire bat that lives in Central and South America. Actually, there's three species of them, I think, today. Yeah. And they do feed on blood, but typically the blood of cattle and deer and things like that. They're actually pretty interesting because they're one of the few bats that spends a lot of time on the ground. Hmm. They run around on the ground, and they have very sharp incisor teeth, razor sharp, that if they nipped you, you wouldn't really even realize you'd gotten bit until you look down and see the blood flowing out. And,
wow.
And so they nip the ankles of cattle, and then they follow along and sort of lap up the puddles of blood that come out from the legs.
They're not really evolved until they give you a little cup of juice and a cookie,
exactly,
I think, when they're done.
Haven't gotten that far
yet.
Okay.
I'm thinking about that, too. Now that you say it, are there any other mammals that live on blood?
I don't think so, but
that's an interesting adaptation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, there certainly are a lot of insects that do, as you well know, and things like that. But it is an interesting adaptation. The South American, they live in South America with several other close relatives who have become very adept at utilizing different kinds of food. So most bats eat insects, but this group that includes vampires also has forms that are nectar feeders, some that feed on other animals that are carnivores, some eat fruits. And so, bats are adaptable just like anything else. And given an opportunity, they'll take advantage of it.
Whatever they can get.
Yeah.
We started this conversation talking about the fossils you've found. Are they particularly difficult to find?
They can be. I mean, they're because the skeletons are fragile, they don't preserve very well oftentimes unless you have a very unique set of circumstances. The best specimens, in some ways, in an odd way, are the oldest because we find them in lake deposits. Mm. So bats, the ones that we have found, probably were hunting over the water or something, and maybe for whatever reason crashed and burned into the lake and just floated down to the bottom in very quiet sediments and got covered up fairly quickly. And so we have nice skeletons of bats from very early. But typically what we find are cave deposits, and oftentimes they're just very acidic environments, and so all that's left really are teeth and jaws. But sometimes you can find thousands of teeth and jaws in the same cave deposits. So you can sort of have a very high number, but the completeness is not so good. Yeah. Oftentimes,
I mean, it brings us to the kind of perfect storm you need to even get a fossil in the first place.
Yeah, of course. I mean, there's it's a pretty high probability that once an animal dies, it's not going to get preserved because there's other things that are going to eat parts of it and it will just desiccate or whatever. But yeah, if you, particularly in lakes, if you land in the lake and sink to the bottom, oftentimes in the middle of lakes, there's what's called anoxic conditions where there's no oxygen and nothing lives there. And so there's no bacteria eating you or anything. And so it's a pretty good way to kind of preserve things.
I'm looking back at my introduction of you, and it says you're in the Division of Fossil Primates at the Duke Lemur Center.
Right, exactly.
And we've been talking about bats for the last 15 minutes.
Exactly.
Can you make the connection for me?
Well, you know, it's all about fossils in my case. And I actually worked on primates quite a bit early in my career. And it was more by accident that I got into bats. I went to a fossil excavation in Tanzania. I was invited along as the person to, in case we ever found a mammal, we weren't expecting to because it was a lake deposit and we were finding fish and we were finding seeds and fruits and things like that. But we found a skeleton of a mammal, and it turned out it was a bat. And so I was the only one who was really there to study mammals, and so I started studying this thing, and it kind of got me interested in bats, and that kind of started my whole career in bat research. So,
just for today, it would have been a better story if you had been reading a Batman comic book.
I know. I known, I could have.
But that's actually a great story. I mean, you know, here you are, the mammal expert, and you get turned on to bats and kind of haven't turned back. Also, though, you've done a little bit of research on a strange animal that was famous recently in the papers for having Mick Jagger lips.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Tell us about the Mick Jagger.
Part of the place that I work, we have a big collection of fossils from Egypt, and one of the places that we work there is a place called Wadi Mogra, which is about a 19-million-year-old locality, and it has these anthracotheres from them. The anthracotheres are artiodactyls, kind of like hippos maybe or something like that, or a large deer-sized form anyway. And we discovered a new taxon, a new species. And based on our reconstructions of the skull, which we had some pretty good pieces of it, we felt that it had like fairly large mobile lips, sort of like a moose maybe or a saiga or something. People probably don't know what a saiga is, but it's an artiodactyl that lives in Asia and has fairly large lips. And so we were looking for a name, and, you know, it came down to Mick Jagger, Angelina Jolie, and we decided Mick Jagger would be happier to have named after him.
Less likely to sue, more likely to go along
with
the joke. Yeah, I get it. What do we suppose those, now that you say it, you know, what's the advantage of that sort of lip structure? Do we know?
These animals were probably wading in shallow waters and, you know, sort of like a moose, I would guess, and probably just using those to sort of crop, you know, vegetation, aquatic vegetation. We've done some isotope studies of their teeth, for example, and a lot of them were eating aquatic plants, as far as we can tell. And so this is just one mechanism in which they could have gathered their food, probably. So.
We certainly know the advantage to Mick Jagger.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that part, no question. So you're going to be giving a talk this Saturday at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. Give us a preview. What are you talking about?
Yeah, well, I'm going to talk about mostly what we talked about today. I'm going to go over living bats for a few minutes and talk about some other sort of you know, fallacies that people have about bats and what they believe in, you know, things.
Like, do they like my hair?
They do not like your hair. Then that's probably the last place any bat would ever want to be, my hair or your hair or anybody else's hair. And so I'll do that first, and then we'll talk a little bit about the fossil record and the history of bats and globally. So.
Sounds great, but now you have offended Mick Jagger, Angelina Jolie, and my barber.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay. We'll have you back, Greg.
Excellent. Thank you. I would appreciate it.
Greg Gunnell is the director of the Division of Fossil Primates at the Duke Lemur Center. He's going to be giving a talk Saturday for the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences Paleopalooza in Raleigh at 12:30. You can find out all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, the music of Marcus Anderson. Please stay with us.